I'm lucky to have the fire chief of the Antwerp Fire Brigade as one of my best friends. So we go a long way. I know him when he was still an officer at the fire, when he was as a young officer looking for how can we change things here? Because we have to change the fire brigade from within, and we have to look more to academia, to science, because we are doing a lot of things based on gut feeling or based on traditions. So back in 2013, I was in my final year of my PhD. I wrote a scientific paper together with him that we published on a typical case that happened within the fire brigade in Antwerp, where we were asking ourselves, well, how did they manage this? And then since then, we are on a conversation. So we, on a regular basis, we do talk to each other, we meet for a coffee, and then have a conversation about our mutual interest, which is crisis management, crisis governance. So now what I see in the fire brigade, and especially in the conversations I have with Bert, that's the name of the fire chief, is that we both share this view on crisis management. And we both see, and this is also linking, Nancy, to your previous questions, why I moved to academia, is because I see a lot of myths in when it comes to crisis management. We still think that we can manage crisis situations. Now, if you're a little bit familiar with crises, then you know that you can't manage. You can't manage a crisis. Managing in the strict sense of the word is impossible. You're always too late. You're running behind the fact. So you can muddle through, yes. You can try to coordinate the best you can. You can try to intervene the best you can, but you cannot manage it in that strict sense of the word. So that's one myth. Another myth is, and that is linking to the fire service, is there is this idea that we need a strong leader. When there is a crisis, we need a strong leader. And preferably a white male with a lot of stars and stripes. And then, yeah, and he will take charge of the crisis situation. That's not reality. That's not how it's working. We see that in a crisis situation, we don't need one strong leader. We need multiple good leaders.
My guest today is Hugo Marinissen. He is an expert in crisis governance and risk management, co-holding the chair of crisis governance at the University of Antwerp. Our conversation today will address the question of how leaders might structure organizations to better adapt to an uncertain world. He identifies key myths and assumptions that are part of traditional models that simply do not work in times of crisis. He is a senior partner at PM Risk Crisis Change and a senior researcher at the University of Antwerp in the Business and Economics Management Department and professor at Antwerp Management School. The focus of his current research is on crisis networks, organizational resilience, normal chaos, and the role of crisis governance as a way to anticipate extreme events. You can check out the links in the bio show notes to get more information about Hugo's research and work. I start our conversation today by asking him to share his working definition of crisis governance. So let's get started.
Okay. Thank you. Good question. Crisis governance, if you look at this term, basically these are two bone things. So one is the crisis, which is really a decision point. It's typically associated with difficulty, with danger, with threats, with uncertainty, everything you don't like, that's the crisis. Yeah. But also crisis is a very temporal thing. So it doesn't continue, it stops. And very often the crisis situation, if we think about a fire, if we think about an explosion, whatever. Yeah. So in time, it doesn't take a lot of time. The consequences of the crisis might take a long time, but the crisis itself is relatively short. Now, at the other hand, there we have governance, and governance, we look from a management and organization theory perspective. That's my background. So I'm the faculty of business and economics in the management department. So looking from that angle, we generally relate governance to roles, very formal roles, to structure, to authority, and not as something temporal, but as something that is more looking at stability, reliability. So these are two, at first sight, competing terms. And the idea of these competing terms comes from discussions I had with multiple colleagues over the last couple of years. And it stems back to, or it goes back to Charles Sparrow. That's your fellow compatriot, Charles Sparrow, who wrote in 19 the book Normal Accidents, Living with the High-Risk Technologies. Charles Sparrow, he was a professor at Yale, sociologist, and he analyzed very complex systems from a sociological perspective. So he was looking at how are we as human beings are dealing with very complex systems. And they came to the conclusion, basically, that accidents are normal because we are human beings. And as human beings, we are error-making machines. We make a lot of errors, and thanks to those errors, we make mistakes. And therefore, mistakes will lead to accidents. Now, in all these conversations and in a lot of studying around this topic, I came to the concept of normal chaos, similar to Charles Sparrow's idea of normal accidents. Came to normal chaos with the idea of crisis is something very normal. The world we're living in is very chaotic. And in that chaotic world, if you think about it, in some way, we manage to create some kind of order. Not always, it's chaotic, it's messy, but if you think about it, there are a lot of things that might go wrong during a day. And still, at the end of the day, we are all alive, and we are all doing well, and everything is hunky-dory. But sometimes something is getting out of control, and that may be another definition, crisis. So how can we then think about a kind of a structure, a kind of stability in terms of governance, where we link it back to organizations? A governance principle or a couple of principles in the governance structure of an organization that might anticipate a potential crisis, that already might look at what is happening here. How can we try to anticipate and try to avoid to slowly but steadily drift into a crisis situation? But this is also with the idea of we as human beings, we have to recognize and admit that we create disasters. And that to root cause, if we are, and maybe later on in this conversation, we can talk about this idea of root causes and cause and effect, et cetera. But that root cause of the crisis situation basically is lying among us.
I think that it would be helpful to understand a little bit about your background and how you got to this point. Walk us back to your thinking and how you came at this and chose this for your field. In fact, you told me in our last meeting that you accidentally ended up in academia. And I think that's a compelling aspect of you. So go ahead and give us a little background.
I'm what they call a precademic. Mm-hmm. So I started working in practice. I had my own consultancy firm back in the days, 2004. Started this, so this year, celebrating 20 years, advising companies, organizations, both profits, public organizations, on how to deal with crisis management, crisis communication, crisis operations. And then at a certain moment in time, I was a bit frustrated in the sense of that a lot of things I saw that was happening and it was not going in the right direction, I could point to them and indicate them and say, this is not how this is working. But based on what? Well, based on my experience, based on logic, based on gut feeling, but not based on science. So that was for me the starting point to say, I go back to university and I want to dive deeper into this. I want to learn. I want to understand. I want to go beyond these. We all know that. Yeah. So decided first to do a master's, executive master's in Oxford and Paris on change management, because a lot of the change we see happening in organizations is managed so badly and leading to crisis situations very often, be it financial crisis, social crises, etc. And then afterwards, I really got the joy of discovering new things and linking theory to practice, but also seeing things happening in practice and then asking myself, what is theory saying about it? And is there a match or a mismatch? Whatever. And then I went to Bramfield University in the UK, where I did a PhD part-time. So I was still running my business and then did on a part-time basis my doctoral studies. And when I finished there, I accidentally ended up in a business school in Antwerp, the Antwerp Management School, where they asked me to become the academic director of an executive PhD program, one I just finished in Cranfield. And I thought, yeah, that's fun. It might be fun. It's something different. And initially I came there to ask whether they were in search for someone sharing knowledge about risk management, crisis management, etc. So there I got the perfect opportunity to combine this knowledge, but also do at the same time some research. And we did some research at the fire service in Antwerp, but also to help professionals, executives, to pick up a research project and become a PhD, an executive PhD, as we call it. So that's a bit of my background. So you have sometimes things just happen by accident, and then you have to go with the flow and enjoy it.
Yeah, I want to take a bit of a deep dive. You touched on your work with the fire service, and this makes me think about just you're attracted to the real world scenarios, and the fire service, if anything, is that. It really represents the boots on the ground. And yet, what was it about the fire service that stood out for you in terms of the work they do and how they interact with crises?
Yep.
Can you share?
Oh, very good. Also very broad question. Very interesting.
I wasn't prepared for that question, but I really can't miss this because we are doing a series right now that touches on fire service in every episode.
Yeah. I'm lucky to have the fire chief of the Antwerp Fire Brigade as one of my best friends. So we go a long way. I know him when he was still an officer at the fire, when he was as a young officer looking for how can we change things here? Because we have to change the fire brigade from within, and we have to look more to academia, to science, because we are doing a lot of things based on gut feeling or based on traditions. So back in 2013, I was in my final year of my PhD. I wrote a scientific paper together with him that we published on a typical case that happened within the fire brigade in Antwerp, where we were asking ourselves, well, how did they manage this? And then since then, we are on a conversation. So we, on a regular basis, we do talk to each other. We meet for a coffee and then have a conversation about our mutual interest, which is crisis management, crisis governance. So now what I see in the fire brigade and especially in the conversations I have with Bert, that's the name of the fire chief, is that we both share this view on crisis management. And we both see, and this is also linking, Nancy, to your previous questions, why I moved to academia, is because I see a lot of myths in when it comes to crisis management. We still think that we can manage crisis situations. Now, if you're a little bit familiar with crises, then you know that you can't manage. You can't manage a crisis. Managing in the strict sense of the word is impossible. you're always too late. You're running behind the fact. So you can muddle through, yes. You can try to coordinate the best you can. You can try to intervene the best you can, but you cannot manage it in that strict sense of the word. So that's one myth. Another myth is, and that is linking to the fire service, is there is this idea that we need a strong leader. When there is a crisis, we need a strong leader. And preferably a white male with a lot of stars and stripes. And then, yeah, and he will take charge of the crisis situation. That's not the reality. That's not how it's working. We see that in a crisis situation, we don't need one strong leader. We need multiple good leaders. Multiple good leaders who do connect with each other, who do work together, who share the work, who do understand each other. That's what we need. And not only white male with stars and stripes. So that's a second myth. Right? And then another myth. So there are multiple myths that we see. And that I see that within the fire brigade or the fire service, there is also this culture a little bit of an old-fashioned culture very often. Yeah, you have the fire chief and he or she is the boss. I will tell you what to do. And all the rest is executing those commands. And that is completely changing, luckily, slowly but steadily it's changing. And I see in some fire services where it's changing very rapidly. They bring in the knowledge from below. People with their boots on the ground who do have knowledge, who are eager to learn new things.
Let me ask you, just for clarity's sake, in your country, in this fire brigade, is this fire chief full-time, paid? Is it a paid fire service?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So this is the biggest fire service in Belgium, as we have the ports of Antwerp in the territory. And as you probably know, the port of Antwerp is number two worldwide after Houston, port of Houston. It's number two in terms of the biggest petrochemical cluster worldwide. Yeah, it's a full-time job. They only have professional firefighters, no volunteers. And it's, yeah.
And who does the fire chief report to?
To the mayor.
So we certainly have that in this country. The state that I'm from, Pennsylvania, we also still have a strong volunteer force. So that is a real influencing factor that is discussed a lot today. And particularly, we have this role of public safety director who sometimes oversees both fire and police. Sometimes there's that cultural clash between emergency services, your ambulance, and your fire and your police cultures are three different. And if that public safety director comes from one of those cultures, they really have to have a broad understanding of the other cultures as well.
Correct. Or it might be a recipe for a disaster, within the disaster.
Exactly. Human systems. Yeah. That are really creating the disaster. And so I do want to deep dive a little bit into a conversation last time when we talked. The Francis Scott Key Bridge had just collapsed in the Baltimore Harbor, and that led to a conversation about your work at the harbor. You learned a little bit about how that works, Seaport. And I think if you could talk a little bit about that study of that system and maybe some of your takeaways, I think it's a fascinating area. And maybe I'll do a follow-up question then.
Yep. It links a bit to what I just mentioned about that we need multiple leaders who can work together and align together. The story is this. Just before the global pandemic in 2020, March 2020, when we were all in a lockdown, that was mid-March, I was in a conversation with the Port of Antwerp. In those days, it was still the Port of Antwerp. Since 2 years, they are merged with the Port of Bruges. So now I have to talk about Port of Antwerp Bruges. But in those days, we were all sitting at home, lockdown, talking to each other via Zoom or Teams or whatever. And I was in a conversation with the port master, the harbor master of Port of Antwerp. And the week before, we had the first interviews, testing interviews for a study. in the port of Antwerp. And we were nagging to each other about, oh, and what is happening? And why are we sitting here? And blah, blah, blah. Typically, because that the first phase, you deny, well, what is exactly happening? And I asked him, like, Niels, what are you doing? So how are you managing this? Because you and the executive team, they're all sitting at home or what? And how do you manage to keep the port open? And he opened his screen and he showed me the logbook and how they are managing this and their management system. And I was there together with the online, together with my colleague, Stephen. And we said, oh, yo, can we have access to the data? Because this is interesting. And he said, yeah, I guess so, because we do have an agreement to do research. So I guess so. So what we did is we were looking at the network within the port of Antwerp and the network that the port of Antwerp was managing or steering during this lockdown. And then we went a little bit back based on archival data to see, could they anticipate what is happening? So with how many actors are they aligning? What are the issues they are discussing? How many issues, how many connections do they make? And that's what we were looking at. So at the end, so we were looking at the period between January 2020 and beginning of May 2020, that, let's say, the first wave of COVID-19. And what we found was that they were managing 50 different actors, which is unbelievable. At a certain moment, 57 actors within their network. And together they were discussing up to 195 issues, going from small issues to major issues. Among these actors, there are authorities like the local authority, the regional authority, the federal authorities, the European authorities as well. And then you have all the stakeholders within, inside and outside of the port they are dealing with. And they had more than 480 connections, moments where they connected with the whole network or a part of the network or whatever to achieve their goal. And their goal was, we have to keep the port open at all costs. That was their main goal. So we published this in a public administration review. You can download it there. It's still freely available, I think. But what we learned is that the key to success, and that's also where this governance is coming from, where crisis governance is linking to, is that the key to success is how you organize the various networks and agents around your organization. It's an illusion that it's only one network. No, there are multiple networks around your organization, like the port. And how do you organize them? And how do you organize them without obstructing the autonomy of those individual organizations, parties, or networks? Because then if you do that, then it comes to who's the boss here. No, we don't do this. We do not obstruct the autonomy. Every individual, every agent, every network is autonomous. But how do we organize them together around a very clear, engaging purpose? And this purpose was, we have to keep the port open. If the port is closing, that will have a massive effect, not only negative effect, not only in Belgium, but in a large part of Europe, because that port is a gateway to Europe for all kinds of goods, food, etc. And then another thing we learned there is, how do you selectively integrate people and means? It's not only about, oh yeah, everyone can join us and let's solve this. No, we're going to selectively integrate people, saying, oh yeah, you from your organization, you have those skills that can help us to solve this problem. And then the final one is that there should be a kind of what we call self-regulation within this network. It's having the flexibility to quickly adapt and change when the environment is changing. So how can you self-regulate you and your network?
Can we do some takeaways from this? And let me just test a few out. So my question would be, did you sense as you were going through the system organization that there was a lot brought forward that was preserved from this is the way we've done it for a long time? And to what extent has technology become dominant and do those coexist? Are people still like having face-to-face meetings? Are these networks preserved and also documented, or is it more adapting, evolving and adapting, and this is the way we do it?
Mm-hmm. Kind of. Yep. Technology is key. That's very clear. And the good thing was that due to their relationships with other ports around the globe, they already got those signals that something big was heading towards us. So from mainly ports in Asia, but this COVID thing is really serious. Be aware of it. So they already started to prepare them, but on the part of technology, to make sure that people had laptops, they had connections at home as well, that they were able to work from home prior to the lockdown. So they did a good job. Second thing, did it exist already? No. During that period, let's say March, May, I was at home. So I never met anyone from the port physically. It wasn't allowed here. So afterwards, May, June, July, we did interviews with all the members of the executive team. Most of them via Teams or Zoom, but with the CEO, it was a physical meeting. And he said at a certain moment, he said, if this would have been COVID-17 instead of 19, we would have failed. Mm-hmm. So our organization was not ready 2 years ago. Now, he came in office in 2016, 17, and dramatically changed the whole organization. So he said, we just finished that exercise. So was it 1 year before or 2 years before, we would have failed. Right. So yeah. And that's one of the learnings also. So they managed somehow, because they had good contacts with all their stakeholders, to align them around this clear purpose. In most other cases, they start to discuss first the purpose. What is the purpose? And my purpose might be a different one than yours. And before we align on that, then we can start organizing. Then you're way too late. So having a clear purpose, knowing each other, already discussing how to do this, training and practicing this, and maintaining your network is it's of pivotal importance.
Yeah. I'm just curious if the CEO was talking about change in a cultural way, or was it communication systems, just change in leadership?
It was change in the organization and in leadership. So he came as an external into that organization. So he was appointed as the new CEO, and he changed the leadership team. He changed the way they were working. It was a massive change. So it just was about to finish when COVID-19 started.
Yeah. It's interesting. I guess COVID helped us get very clear on what we were doing right, as well as what we were doing not so well. And it has a snap effect. If you were on your way to doing something wrong, it went really wrong. If you had put in some developments, I heard just so many employers tell me that it was just so fortunate that they had done work to enable a hybrid or remote work style. That was a real key. But so much more, I think, that allowed them to adapt.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Agree. It's about anticipation. How do you anticipate? How do you detect early warning signals? Is there a system in place that can help you to detect them in the first place, and then second, make sense out of it?
Yeah.
You might detect something, but if the leadership team is not making sense out of it, then
right.
It's useless.
Yeah, this is a whole other conversation that fascinates me, but more related to safety. So if information is coming in, these are some things we're hearing. What's happening to that? Is it stopping before it gets up into the system, or are there ways to actually talk about issues that are coming from the field, the front line, those who are in the know?
Correct.
So let's move on just a little bit from here. I think that part of what I hear you say is that the development of relationships or networks is a key part of that's sharing knowledge, trust. But I'd like to hear if you have a working definition of resilience or resiliency that you refer to or how you think about it, because I think that term gets thrown around a lot without anyone really being clear on what is meant. Mm-hmm. And I know we all are, this is an evolving definition, but from your perspective, what does it mean?
Yeah, I think everyone is talking about resilience these days. And we also see that in the literature, the term resilience has exponential growth in publications since 2020. And resilience appeared for the first time in scientific management research in the 80s of last century. It was introduced by an American, Aaron Wildavsky. I don't know if I pronounce his name correctly. And he said, and I'm quoting him, he said, it's the capacity to cope with unanticipated dangers as they become manifest, learning to bounce back. And boom, everyone since then is talking about bouncing back when they are talking about resilience. Now, I don't really like this link to bouncing back, because it has to do with when you fall, that you can bounce back. Yeah, but you might also bounce forward, or maybe you might break. So therefore, my definition of resilience is based on a publication from Langnick Hall in early 2010-2011, something, where he says resilience is the capacity to effectively absorb shocks, to develop situation-specific responses that allow you to deal with those shocks, ultimately to engage in transformative activities that take advantage of disruptive surprises that may threaten the survival of the organization. Now, this is one that I like, because here he's talking about surprises, disruptive surprises that might threaten the survival of an organization. So it might really bring you into danger. It might be the end of the survivability of your organization or a part of your organization. But at the same time, he's also talking about looking at to take the advantage of such a surprises. So not only looking at the negative side, but also looking at the positive side. Well, we were just talking about detecting early warning signals. Then you can say these are warning signals for something negative or something positive. And then from an organization perspective, from a private perspective, you can say, but also from a public perspective, if you see some signals or you detect some signals that indicate some potential advantage, you can take them and prosper from that situation, yeah, rather than only looking from a negative view on this. So that's basically my definition. That it's not only mine; it's based on on some giant and shines.
Would you relate this to this you mentioned in the opening, that just the way we look at our reality today, that we don't see everything as a crisis. In my words, it's more we see new possibilities, like being able to understand that there is another story, that we don't necessarily have to wed ourselves to what is right now, what we see. And I think about what you said, which is maybe just understanding that it isn't about solving the crisis as much as it is about, and you can give me your words, but like the understanding that we are living in a time of uncertainty, that it is a long horizon for some of the types of challenges that
we are feeling
on a daily basis.
Yeah, correct. And it's looking at, it's paradoxical at the same time. So you have to look at threats as well as opportunities and deal with this. And typically what we see is that organizations who are dealing, like startups, for instance, their learning curve is enormous in the beginning. And they do all new things and they learn and they thrive. Why? Because everything they explore, they go deeper into this, et cetera, et cetera. And there is a theory that's also from the 90s, David Hurst, I think, if I'm not wrong, who said, actually, if you look at traditional organizations, after a while, they stop learning. They continue to do what they learn to do. So maybe you have to create a kind of creative disruption in this organization, create a kind of crisis in an organization to help them to learn again, to go through this phase of exploring, grasping for new opportunities, struggling, but then learning. And so to bring in the learning in the organizations again and again. So that's, and then we are talking about a kind of, I think he called it, a positive anarchy or something like that. So yeah, you have to change things. Otherwise, we are just sitting back, relaxed, and everything is going well. And it isn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that theory has a lot of heuristic value, but I think that a lot of people would tell you it can create mental health hazards in your organization, speaking from a consultant who often gets called in. But I think that you're at root, the idea that there might be a disruption. For instance, it can be technology that can create a crisis in some organizations, new technology or leadership, or the you have to shift the energy in the organization to go in a new direction. It's interesting, but I do want to know, in the reality of organizations as they are today, tell me if your observation is different, but there is just in the global organizations, more silos, even though we have this really fast communication and extensive networks. I don't see progress in terms of how information is managed or transmitted, but I still think that there's a huge amount of siloed networks. And on one level, there can be some great messaging. These websites are beautifully made. But when you talk to people within this global organization, they don't know anybody over in that other division. And it gets very heavy. And I think this is an unsafe situation. So the avian flu in this country, one of the one thing that I hear is that this is this huge agricultural industrial complex. When you have things that are this large, this big size, it can be more difficult to manage a crisis.
Oh, yeah. I think effectively coordinating and resolving a crisis requires more than just collaboration among the traditional partners or the people or the traditional emergency and disaster relief services. In my opinion, it requires collaboration and cooperation among a broad network of partners. And this is exactly what we saw in this research in the Port of Antwerp, where you have more than 50 partners who do not work on a day-to-day basis with each other. If you can align them, bring them together, give them the same or a good purpose, or make sure that everyone is adhering to that same purpose and with respect for each other, which is really important, that I think it's an illustration of what you're just saying here is, how do you do this? By having, putting a kind of North Star up there at the horizon.
You use the term autonomous networks. I think that is a fascinating concept, whether we're talking governments or business, and understanding that there's autonomous networks within the organization and recognizing that can be a critical key to success.
Yeah, we have to think in that way because sometimes we don't realize or we don't want to realize how complex the environment is we are living in, what the dynamics in that environment are. and that you as an individual organization, be it public or private, you cannot keep pace with a rapidly evolving environment. So you have to rely on others.
Yeah.
On multiple partners.
Yeah. I don't know if there is a practical sort of summation of what this looks like in day-to-day leadership, but I think it can be done so many different ways. I think that's the point, is that like the CEO that you talked to at the port, that leaders have an idea of how they might facilitate more collaborative exchange, is one way to say it, shared knowledge. I hear what you're dealing with over in your area, and I realize there's something that we do over here that there's an intersection, and maybe we can fix that together. Like, it's that constant possibility for connection that is valuable, even though it may feel like, why do I have to go to this event or this meeting? But it's, I think, a leader who understands how to design or set that up and facilitate that has a great advantage. Yeah.
Maybe I can give you a small example of something that's happening in your country, namely in Houston, Port Houston. They have already for more than 70 years CIMA. And CIMA stands for Channel Industries Mutual Aid. It's a nonprofit organization that is combining the fire service, rescue, hazardous materials handling, and emergency medical capabilities of all the refining and petrochemical industry in the greater Houston metropolitan area. Now, what they are doing, mainly, the whole idea is we all have our emergency services, fire services, etc. So if something is happening with my neighbor, we can come and help him. Yeah. And if something is happening in my facility, they will come and help me. Besides, of course, general fire service that will come also. But it's about time, and time is of essence when there is a fire or an emergency situation. So how can we help each other? Now, this network that already exists since the 50s of last century, they do meet on a regular basis. And one of my colleagues was there to research how the port of Houston is dealing with crisis situations and also to look at CIMA. And he was invited to a meeting, and he was sitting there, and all these people came from this area, and it's a huge area, right? So some of them, they had to drive almost an hour to be at that meeting. And there they were sitting, drinking coffee, having a croissant, and then talking about a lot of things, also about work, also about private things. And then the meeting started. And my colleague, he's German. And so efficiency is of key, right? So he was thinking, right, they are losing valuable time. Why are these people driving in? They can also meet online, right? So afterwards, he discussed this with the chief of CIMA. And he said, we are organizing this already for 70 years. Yeah. And so we invest in this, in time, in coffee, in
relationships,
bustles, yeah, in relationships, et cetera, et cetera. And this is so important. So it's an investment. It's really an investment. If you think about it, if you take only the hours, what it will cost to bring all those people together, oh yeah, for every meeting, we are talking about multiple thousands of dollars. Mm. But it pays off the very moment something is happening, because you know each other, you trust each other, you know what is happening, going on in your organization, etc. So this is, I think, a nice example of how do you bring people together? How do you create that community, that trust? Because trust is really of key essence here.
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful illustration. And I can just picture in Texas, it would probably took some of them a day to get there. It's such a large state. Think about also just the fact that when we have our work persona on online remotely, if that's the only aspect you know of a person, it becomes much harder to ask something of them if you need something. And it becomes much harder to say, I don't know how to do something. But once you're in those meetings and you're talking, you're like, that person is just like me. They have the same challenges, and it just changes that, even if it only happens once a year, I don't know how often they meet, but yeah, I think it does change the compliment.
Or less than once a year, right? Once every so many years. We hope that you never need that network.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the whole objective. So
it's really great. Thank you so much, Hugo. I want to wrap this up in thinking about this idea back to a sort of formal definition of governance. And in the recent paper you co-authored, which I'll mention in the show notes, it breaks the definition of governance down to governance is concerned with overall structure, policies, and processes that guide decision-making and behavior within an organizational system. It's like to think about the micro-level interactions as a part of that governance system. And I think that squares with your sort of expanded view of governance. In this paper, you go just a little bit further into understanding what that looks like. And I wanted to ask your thoughts about whether a governance structure, to what extent it might be not necessarily explicit, that there might be implicit within that structure ways in which people interact with the system that we don't necessarily formally recognize. And if we understand that is part of governance, I just think there is a healthier system, that it's not always because the decision-making body says so, that there are other layers within the stakeholder system that come to bring some influence or weigh in on how things work. And I'm curious about your reaction to that.
It's a very broad expression. Where do I start here? There are multiple things going through my head right now.
Yeah, I'm not sure this is good or bad. This is just an open-ended way of thinking. Because we've touched on fire service, I think there is sometimes within a structure, a governance structure, let's talk about the port. Where does the fire service sit in that? Is it just, it might be a naive question as well, that when something happens, there's a time that the fire chief is now in charge. Are there other times when the fire chief says, if you do X, Y, Z, we are going to be not happy because that's going to impact our status or our assets or...
I don't know. You should ask him. He might be a great guest in your podcast. Yeah. Happy to share his coordinates, but I'm just hovering around this idea of that we typically did this, going back to the way we think about managing, the way we think about governing, which is a very linear way of thinking very often, where we can say, yeah, you have cause and effect. And the effect is we see that things are going wrong. So therefore, we have to go back to the root cause and then try to anticipate and make sure that this will never happen again. That's one thing. Like this, the example you gave, that a fire chief might say, you can do whatever you want, but not this, because otherwise I will be in trouble and this will cost your head or whatever. In terms of leadership, because then we come to the level of leadership, then we come to the level of taking courage in an organization, whether it's a public or a private organization. I think, and maybe this is might be politically not really correct what I'm saying here, but I strongly believe that we are slowly but steadily sliding into a kind of crisis society. And at the end of the day, we are causing those crises as human beings. Now, typically for a crisis society, as I call it, I steal this term a little bit from Ulrich Beck, who in the 90s published world famous book, Risk Society. So we can say that it's a crisis society. We can say that I see that this fear of things are going in a bad way and who will be responsible at the end of the day for this, that this thrives best in a climate that lacks political courage. And
just said a big thing there.
It's a very big thing what I'm saying. Yeah, but we can, let me explain a little bit. But I see, and that links back to governance, I see a lack of, and it's on a global scale. So I'm not, and let me just look at my country and how we are, but I think I see it also in other countries, that there is a lack of good governance and policy, a lack of a long-term vision very often. That we have to make decisions that will have an impact, a positive impact on the future, but that we are afraid, and I say we, because also we as non-politicians are afraid that those decisions would be made, because, and politicians are afraid because they are very unpopular choices to make such a decision. And then think about a lot of issues that we have to tackle, basically.
Yeah.
In terms of whatever, but that is leading to this sense of all the time there is turmoil, financial insecure and uncertainty. We see war, we see signs of black and white opposing opinions, and then two camps, and where is the gray in the middle? Oh, we don't want to discuss this because I'm going into a slippery alley right now by saying this. But it is something that I think is not helping to take this governance very seriously, in the sense of saying, yes, we do have to make unpopular choices, maybe. And it's not for the short term, but it's for the long term. How can we make sure that as a society, as an organization, as a business, we are still standing there in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years? We are all talking about ESGs, environment, social, and governance. Yeah. And that's so pivotal here in Europe. This is a huge thing. Every company has to apply ESG principles. There is the G from governance, but also from societal, social, societal, and environmental. So how do we bring this in as a kind of antidote for this crisis society?
Yes, I really think that courage hits the nail on the head. I hear so often that collaboration takes too much time, and that there's a reason why we have people elected to lead or business leaders to lead. And I think that there is some wisdom that there is, it's up to those leaders to determine the level of collaboration that might be necessary. But there is this, if there is an influence, and I'm thinking now within a community that the business, the unequal power, that the business industry has so much power that those environmental standards or something else is not being considered, then you have a closing down of the work across that's needed in the event that there is some major crisis or disaster, and the politicians that have to make a decision, do we make something out of this or do we let the business do what they do? So it does take a lot of political courage. And from my point of view, there is a real need to engage elected officials just from my work in the public sector to talk more about crisis governance and why it is so important to open up those conversations. It's not that you have to collaborate on every single decision, but pick the ones that are really central to those standards. There's so much here, but it's such an important conversation, Hugo. And you're doing
it. Sorry to interrupt you, Nancy, but when I just said we are causing crisis situations, we as human beings, yeah, so I think it's unfair to say, yeah, but it's difficult for politicians. No, we are electing them in the first place.
Yeah, so really, yeah. We need to be having conversations with ourselves.
Yeah, that's one thing. Second is, it just comes to mind a quote from Peter Drucker. He And he said, the greatest danger in times of turbulence is not the turbulence itself, it's to act with yesterday's logic. So if we don't adapt our logic, if we are not willing to sit down now and say, hold on a second, are the structures we are working in still doing the work? Are the plans we are making still adequate? Are the processes we have in place to deal with each other, to run business, to run society, are they still adequate or what? Because the world is moving on and moving fast forward. So maybe we have to adapt our logic now and then. So I really like that quote.
Yeah, that's a great one. Tell me, Hugo, is there anything else that you might want to bring up as we come to a close here that keeps you up at night or is on your mind?
Oh, what keeps me up at night? A lot of things. No, I sleep well. Thank you very much. But what if there is something, as a metaphor to say that what keeps me up at night, is that apparently we tend to forget to learn from our mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something I constantly see in organizations. And we all experience this during COVID-19. For example, we all said, oh, there will be a time before and after. After this COVID-19 thing, we will talk about the pre and past COVID-19 period. Because things will dramatically change. Today, we are still doing exactly the same as we did before COVID-19. Yeah. So there is very little, apparently, that we learn from crisis situations or negative situations. And I see this in multiple layers. I see this on a societal level. I also see this in organizations where they do have an incident, for instance, and then they have a formal or an informal evaluation commission, and then they write reports, and then in the report it's recommendations, and this should never happen again. And then you see that a couple of years later, exactly the same thing is happening again. Maybe not in that organization, but in another one. So we don't learn. And it has a lot to do with this, this cause-effect thinking. Yeah. Very often it's, but this was a very specific thing. And that caused this crisis situation. So next time it will be completely different because we kick out that person who made a mistake. And then we're going to have someone else and we will never make this mistake again. But no, you have to think more in systems, like how is the system behaving? And it's not because you change one little thing that the system is healthy again.
The system adapts back to, it went, what's that called, homeostasis, or going back to stable. It wants to do that. Yeah. It takes a long time to affect change, and it's a slow process. And I think just recognizing that, not thinking that, that's done. We've done that, and it's not over. It just keeps, coming back. Hugo, what I hope is that we can talk again in the future. I do think some of these other conversations might trigger another episode. I think your fire chief friend, because you have a good history there, that might be an interesting area to explore as well, because I said, fire services are coming up a lot in the conversations here and the discussion. And I really like our conversations and the sense that we're bringing together some of the practical. We got into some theoretical academic topics today, but I got to bring it down to earth. So I've got to get some engagement with managers and others in the field that can say, what the heck are you guys talking about, really, in practical terms? What does that
mean? Oh, yeah, correct.
And on a day-to-day basis. And that interests me. I think it has, if it's not implementable, it's not understood, then
what? I think close with is, I think we need to get rid, and managers, they need to get rid of this perfect world paradigm. And with the perfect world paradigm, that we have this false idea that we can manage everything, that everything will be under control, and that everything, business is going according to plan.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also what we learn in business schools, that you can perfectly manage everything. And that's not reality. The reality is messier. It's the normal chaos. It's chaos. It's chaotic. And that's normal. Live with it. And things will go wrong. And do we have to be vigilant for that? Yes, definitely. Do we have to be afraid for that? No, because just be prepared. Yeah. So to bring in this or in your organization a healthy touch of chronic unease.
Yeah.
But a healthy one. So not that people get depressed or in burnout or whatever, but this little chronic unease to say it's going too well. What might go wrong? And how can we prepare? How can we think about this? What if?
Yeah. Yes. Be a little uncomfortable every day.
Correct. Yeah, correct. And that, if we can do that from tomorrow, and that's very practical. It's over a coffee, over lunch with your executive team, with your management team, whatever, and just raise the question, what if?
Yeah.
How do we manage? Who do we call? Who do we bring into our network? Do we already have a relationship with that person? Let's have a coffee with that person next time. These are very little things. So if we can do that, we start to learn.
Yeah. Yeah. Intentional conversations. I really appreciate that so much, Hugo. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Yeah. And let's stay in touch. Let me know when you're going to broadcast this. I will make fuss on LinkedIn about it.
Yeah. Good. Thank you.
I will not listen to it because I don't like to listen to my voice so much.
I'm the same way, but I have to. It's torture. But I'm lucky because I can edit my part out. So it'll just be you talking. But your voice is lovely, Hugo. But I know how you feel. Yeah.
All right.
All right.
Nancy, see you later. Have a nice Friday and a nice weekend.
Yes, please.
And I look forward to talking again.
Okay. Let's do that. Thank you so much. See you.
Okay, well, bye-bye.